general point that I would have drawn from your three talks is that you're all more optimistic about using stem cells in in vitro models to understand disease and to screen for drugs than in the second proposal that Kristen described, which is replacing disease neurons. And maybe you just give us a 30-second commercial as to why replacement is not now on the table. What do we need to do to move to replacement? Kristen.
Well, that's a great question. I think the reason we're so excited about the disease models is because we can basically do it right now. And people are doing it in their labs, and there's a great need for these things. People are also doing cell replacement therapy in the spinal cord that I know of, and in Parkinson's disease, maybe others are. That is tricky, right? You need approvals, and you need a very serious disease to take that risk. So I think if we have time to do a lot more work in animal models before we go into humans, we'll have a lot, in combination with the in vitro work, we'll have a lot better chance of success, and we won't run the risk of hurting anybody.
Thank you. Eve or Larry? Yeah,
so I think I'm pretty much agreeing with what Christine had said. I think the whole replacement aspect of the study is just at a very infantry stage. I mean, there's just a lot of groundwork needs to be done. On the other hand, I wanted to be a little bit more positive because one needs to know that in our brain, there are at least two areas that has ongoing turnover of the new neurons, and then these neurons will be able to integrate into the circuits. So if we can understand how these two areas enable those cells to do that, it is not sort of fantasy that in other areas we can engage those activities as well for repair, but it's just a long way to go.
Long way to go.
Yeah, I guess I think it depends on the disorder. So in Alzheimer's disease in particular, which is the problem I discussed, I think we don't really know what are the correct neurons to replace, and so I'm a little leery about trying to go in blindly. In Parkinson's, there's slightly better evidence, and although I didn't talk about it, work from us and from Don Cleveland's lab and work we're doing now with Martin Marsala in Lou Gehrig's disease actually I think does provide us with a cell transplant path forward that we're trying to develop now in rats, where the notion there is that even though it's motor neurons that die, the evidence is that it may be possible to keep those cells healthier by providing normal glia, normal astrocytes to them. And so Martin Marsala and we are starting up a project to look at whether that's possible to do in rat models. And then if successful, well, we'll see.
Floyd, if I may interrupt for a second, Rusty Gage is at the back there, and I stuck a mic in his hand. So let's... Do you have any thoughts on this, Rusty?
So, Larry, why do you think these iPS-related cells have a greater propensity for differentiating into neurons? This is true. This seems to be true both for fibroblast-derived and keratinocyte-derived. Do you think this is because they're ectodermal?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, Rusty. And I think that in some ways we don't have enough data to say that they have an enhanced bias. So we have not, for example, done an experiment where we've tried to compare differentiation, say, in EBs or in teratomas to ask, is there a different balance of ectodermal derivatives versus mesodermal or endodermal derivatives in those cases? In a sense, what we've seen anecdotally is that in a co-culture system, they make neurons like gangbusters relative to the human ES-derived cells. My interpretation of that has been, you know, again, based on not a huge amount of data, that it's just that they're younger in some sense. But it could be that you're right, that it's a bias. I mean, certainly that's what Juan Carlos thinks is going on in the keratinocyte-derived iPS lines, and I think it's something that would be interesting to find out.
Now, it looks as though Alison Motor has hijacked that microphone, but let's go to Mark Merkler first.
I was just going to question whether it is indeed that they're very young cells and perhaps have a higher degree of potency than cells that have been in culture for longer periods of time. We also find that the, although again anecdotally, that the iPS cells in the laboratory tend to be differentiating better towards cardiomyocytes.
Are you ready?
Yeah. A question for Kristen, actually. If you start looking at aneuploid neurons, if you see aneuploidy in neurons derived from human ES cells.
I haven't looked at neurons derived from human ES cells, so, but it is a good question.
If you have any questions, please just put your hands up, by the way, and we'll find you with a microphone.
Eve has a comment.
Just a comment on that. So if aneuploidy, you would be able to detect it from an array CGH. We have not found it, just during the normal
Well,
division.
But that's only if each cell has comparable aneuploidy. If it's diverse, so you get an average.
Yeah, then it's going to be an issue.
Mary Devereux, has this raised any thoughts in your mind from an ethical perspective? You had some cause.
Yeah, just we want some, right?
Well, I had a question for the last panel, but maybe I can formulate it in a more general way. That is, there's a lot of evidence of advance. Mark Mercola was talking about screening for toxicity and so on. But the last panelist from the cardio panel was talking about all of the difficulties that we haven't yet solved. And so I guess the general question is, of sort of balancing pushing the research into human trials in particular areas. You mentioned Parkinson's and so on. And I guess I'd like to hear from the panelists where we're already in human trials and what criteria we use to determine when the risk-benefit, as Kristen mentioned, unless the disease is very, very serious, you're asking people to risk a great deal, although we have patients who are desperate enough that they're willing to take that risk.
Well, so I think the real answer is that with human ES-derived materials, there are no human trials yet. With mesenchymal stem cells or hematopoietic stem cells or neural stem cells derived from fetal materials, there are ongoing trials at various stages of maturity. You know, I think that's partly because those stem cells have been, you know, in the lab for a longer period of time, and there's some view that they're generally, quote, safe. I am skeptical that they're quite as safe as seems to be assumed, but so far so good. And of course, they are relatively differentiated relative to embryonic sources and therefore don't have an obvious propensity for teratoma formation or malignancy. But as more and more trials are done, shoving stem cells of various tissue sources into different parts of human patients, I do hope that we haven't misjudged the situation.
And I was just wondering, like Kristen, you were talking about DNA changes happening in the cells, like during differentiation. Have you modeled any? Have you seen any characteristics? Oh, if you become this kind of stem cell, you're going to go this way. If you go this way, you're going to become that kind of stem cell.
You know, we're not really there yet. I mean, what we do know is somatic cells do acquire de novo mutations, and we've in other tissues in the brain looked at some of those. We know that stem cells in a dish acquire de novo mutations. The consequence and the importance of those different mutations, I think, is something we have to test by doing the experiments that we're doing and others are doing. So
you have them here. They're all yours. Any questions?
Here we go.
Question for Larry, perhaps Kirsten. When you're looking at models, especially animal models for Alzheimer's disease, choose your hypothesis, Larry, whichever one you feel comfortable with on a given day. But are you trying to get at the cells where you see the amyloid deposits, the tangles, the plaques, whatever, or are you trying to get at the dementia? And whatever comes first, the inability in people to control amyloid deposits and then link that to a change in dementia has prompted a lot of clinical trials that show that there's too long a time gap between those, and that this has been very confusing to get models that seem to work for the amyloid deposits but then don't translate into the dementia. So what model are you trying to develop in animals that will really predict that you can arrest both the amyloid deposits and the dementia in people?
Well, I think the problem is that I'm not convinced that the amyloid is the primary toxicity in humans or in animals. And so I'm actually not in the process of trying to generate new animal models. I mean, I think really where the bulk of our effort is going is to generate human neurons that carry either familial mutations or carry sporadic genomes, and to ask whether the biochemical changes that we see in animal models that are not amyloid associated yet do seem to reflect disease phenotypes that are well correlated with dementia, we think, whether those are recapitulated in true human neuronal models, and if so, to try to use that for drug testing and drug development. Now, parenthetically, what I'd like to add is that in response to the CIRM disease team initiatives, we've put together a team of folks who are thinking about this problem in AD, Alzheimer's disease. And the approach that we're taking is what I would call mechanistically agnostic. So recognizing that there are many pathologies and biochemical changes that can be detected both in animal models or cellular models of AD, it seems as though if we could develop screening assays in genetically predisposed human neurons that allowed us to alter the progression of those different phenotypes without even worrying about which comes first, which comes later, one might actually have therapeutic benefit from doing that. So, for example, oxidative damage, mitochondrial disturbances, you name it, your favorite model. Because I think at some level they all reflect some part of the puzzle. And we know, for example, from the treatment of cancer, that while we think we understand what the earliest molecular events are in the generation of a malignancy, the bulk of our treatments are actually directed against relatively later stages in the process. That's not to say we shouldn't try to develop things that target earlier, but in fact, therapeutic benefit can be found by targeting later pathways or parallel pathways or what have you. And so that's the viewpoint we're trying to take as a group to develop such assays for drug development, and we'll see.
So we're going to go to Alan Trounce in a second, but before we close, I just wanted to ask you, Floyd, a question, put you on the spot here. Apart from your academic record, apart from your business record with Neurome, apart from having published more papers and written more books than any human is capable of, apart from that, you've been president and chairman of AAAS, editor-in-chief of Science magazine, part of the President's Council on Bioethics. And
are
now,
you coming up to a question, Roger?
And I'm his press agent. Just let me finish. And now on
it sounds like one of those presidential debates.
This is it. Now on CIRM. I mean, nobody in this room has got all that stuff put together. From your perspective, which is somewhat unique, how is this sitting with you, all this the trajectory, the story on stem cells?
The thing about being a scientist is the joy of watching the young scientists come up with solutions to problems we didn't even recognize as problems. So I'm sure Duane has the same experience. When we see the grants that come through CIRM, all of the things that we thought about stem cells could be used for to solve these disease problems are outdistanced by the creative ideas that the people come in with on their grants. And for somebody who watches the flow of science as much as tries to swim in the stream, seeing the new ideas emerge is the most reinforcing part of being a scientist. So it's great.
Great. Thank you very much, Floyd Bloom. Thank you, panel.